the floor. The article was delightful, and we were all so proud and pleased to be mentioned in it. Will Thisbe wants to have a welcome party in your honour. He will bake a potato peel pie for the event and has devised a cocoa icing for it. He made a surprise dessert for our meeting last night, cherries flambé, which fortunately burned down to the pan so we didn't have to eat it. I wish Will would leave cookery alone and go back to ironmongery. We all look forward to welcoming you. You mentioned that you have to finish several reviews before you can leave London, but we will be delighted to see you whenever you come. Just let us know the date and time of your arrival. Certainly an aeroplane flight to Guernsey would be faster and more comfortable than the mail boat. Clovis Fossey said to tell you that air hostesses give gin to passengers and the mail boat doesn't. But unless you are bedeviled by seasickness, I would catch the afternoon boat from Weymouth. There is no more beautiful approach to Guernsey than the one by sea. Either with the sun going down, or with gold-tipped black storm clouds, or the island just emerging through the mist. This is the way I first saw Guernsey, as a new bride. Fondly, Amelia.
From Isola to Juliet. 14th of May, 1946. Dear Juliet, I have been getting your house all ready for you. I asked several of my friends at market to write to you of their experiences, so I hope they do. If Mr. Tatum writes and asks for money for his recollections, don't pay him a penny. He is a big, fat liar. Would you like to know of my first sight of the Germans? I will use adjectives to make it more lively. I don't usually. I favour stark facts. Guernsey seemed quiet that Tuesday, but we knew they were there. Planes and ships carrying soldiers had come in the day before. Huge Junkers thumped down, and after unloading all their men, they flew off again. Being lighter now and more frolicsome, they headshopped, swooping up and swooping down all over Guernsey, scaring the cows in the fields. Elizabeth was at my house, but we couldn't summon up the spirit to make hair tonic, even though my yarrow was in. We just drifted around like a couple of ghouls. Then Elizabeth gathered herself up. "Come on," she says. "I'm not going to sit inside waiting for them. I'm going to town to seek out my enemy." "And what are you going to do after you've found him?" I asks, sort of snappish. "I'm going to look at him," she says. "We're not animals in a cage. They are. They're stuck on this island with us, same as we're stuck with them. Come on, let's go stare." I liked that idea, so we put on our hats and went. But you would never believe the sights we saw in St. Peter Port. Oh, there were hundreds of German soldiers. And they were shopping. Arm in arm they went strolling along Fountain Street, smiling, laughing, peering into store windows, going in shops and coming out with their arms filled with packages, calling out to one another. North Esplanade was filled with soldiers too. Some were just lolling about. Others touched their caps to us and bowed polite-like. One man said to me, "Your island is beautiful. We will be fighting in London soon, but now we have this. A holiday in the sun." Another poor idiot actually thought he was in Brighton. They were buying ice lollies for the streams of children following them. Laughing and having a fine time they were. If it weren't for those green uniforms, we'd have thought the tour boat from Weymouth was in. We started to go by Candy Gardens, and there everything changed. Carnival to nightmare. First we heard noise. The loud, steady rhythm of boots coming down heavy on hard stones. Then a troop of goose-stepping soldiers turned onto our street. Everything about them gleamed. Buttons, boots, those metal coal-scuttle hats. Their eyes didn't look at anyone or anything, just stared straight ahead. That was scarier than the rifles slung over their shoulders, or the knives and grenades stuck in their boot tops. Mr. Fair who'd been in back of us, grabbed my arm. He'd fought on the Somme. Tears were running down his face, and not knowing it, he was twisting my arm, wringing it, saying, "How can they be doing this again? We beat them, and here they are again. How do we let them do this again?" Finally, Elizabeth said, "I've seen enough. I need a drink." I keep a good supply of gin in my cupboard, so we came on home. "I will close now, but I will be able to see you soon, and that gives me joy. We all want to come meet you, but a new fear has struck me. There could be 20 other passengers on the mail boat, and how will I know which one is you? That book photo is a blurry little thing, and I don't want to go kissing the wrong woman. Could you wear a big red hat with a veil and carry lilies? Your friend, Isola."
From an animal lover to Juliet. Wednesday evening. "Dear Miss, I too am a member of the Guernsey Literary and Potato Peel Pie Society, but I never wrote to you about my books, because I only read two, Kiddie's Tales About Dogs, Loyal, Brave and True. Isola says you are coming to maybe write about the occupation, and I think you should know the truth of what our states did to animals. Our own government, mind, not the dirty Germans. They would be ashamed to tell of it, but I am not. I don't much care for people. Never have, never will. I got my reasons. I never met a man half so true as a dog. Treat a dog right, and he'll treat you right. He'll keep you company, be your friend, never ask you no questions. Cats is different, but I never held that against them. You should know what some Guernsey folks did to their pets when they got scared the Germans was coming. Thousands of them quit the island, flew off to England, sailed away, and left their dogs and cats behind. Deserted them. Left them to roam the streets, hungry and thirsty, the swine. I took in as many dogs as I could gather up, but it wasn't enough. Then the states stepped in to take care of the problem, and did worse, far worse. The states warned in the newspapers that because of the war, there might not be enough food for humans, much less for animals. You may keep one family pet, they said, but the states will have to put the rest to sleep. Feral cats and dogs roaming the island will be a danger to the children. And that is what they did. The states gathered them animals into trucks and took them to St. Andrew's Animal Shelter, and those nurses and doctors put them all to sleep. As fast as they could kill one truckload of pets, another truckload would arrive. I saw it all, the collecting, the unloading at the shelter, and the burying. I saw one nurse come out of the shelter and stand in the fresh air, gulping it down. She looked sick enough to die herself. She had herself a cigarette, and then she went back on in to help with the killing. It took 2 days to kill all the animals. That's all I want to say. But put it in your book. An animal lover."
From Sally Ann Frobisher to Juliet. 15th of May, 1946. "Dear Miss Ashton, Miss Pribby told me you would be coming to Guernsey to hear about the war. I hope we will meet then, but I am writing now because I like to write letters. I like to write anything, really. I thought you'd like to know how I was personally humiliated during the war in 1943 when I was 12. I had scabies. There wasn't enough soap on Guernsey to keep clean. Not our clothes, our houses or ourselves. Everyone had skin diseases of one sort or another, scales or pustules or lice. I myself had scabies on top of my head, under my hair, and they wouldn't go away. Finally, Dr. Orman said I must go to town hospital and have my head shaved and cut the tops of the scabs off to let the pus out. I hope you will never know the shame of a seeping scalp. I wanted to die. That is where I met my friend, Elizabeth McKenna. She helped the nurses on my floor. The nurses were always kind, but Miss McKenna was kind and funny. Her being funny helped me in my darkest hour. When my head had been shaved, she came into my room with a basin, a bottle of Dettol, and a sharp scalpel. I said, "This isn't going to hurt, is it? Dr. Orman said it wouldn't hurt." I tried not to cry. "He lied," Miss McKenna said. "It's going to hurt like hell." "Don't tell your mother I said hell." I started to giggle at that, and she made the first slice before I had time to be afraid. It did hurt, but not like hell. We played a game while she cut the rest of the tops off. We shouted out the names of every woman who had ever suffered under the blade. Mary, Queen of Scots. Snip-snap. Anne Boleyn. Whap. Marie Antoinette. Thunk. And we were done. It hurt, but it was fun too, because Miss McKenna had turned it into a game. She swabbed my bald head with Dettol and came in to visit me that evening, with a silk scarf of her own to wrap round my head as a turban. "There," she said, and handed me a mirror. I looked in it. The scarf was lovely, but my nose looked too big for my face, just as it always did. I wondered if I'd ever be pretty, and asked Miss McKenna. When I asked my mother the same question, she said she had no patience with such nonsense, and beauty was only skin deep. But not Miss McKenna. She looked at me, considering, and then she said, "In a little more time, Sally, you're going to be a stunner. Keep looking in the mirror and you'll see. It's bones that count, and you've got them in spades. With that elegant nose of yours, you'll be the new Nefertiti. You'd better practice looking imperious." Mrs. Morgery came to visit me in hospital, and I asked her who Nefertiti was and if she was dead. It sort of sounded like it. Mrs. Morgery said she was indeed dead in one way, but immortal in another way. Later on, she hunted up a picture of Nefertiti for me to see. I wasn't exactly sure what imperious was, so I tried to look like her. As yet, I haven't grown into my nose, but I'm sure it will come. Miss McKenna said so. Another sad story about the occupation is my Aunt Letty. She used to have a big, gloomy old house out on the cliffs near La Fontanelle. The Germans said it lay in their big guns' line of fire and interfered with their gun practice, so they blew it up. Aunt Letty lives with us now. Yours sincerely, Sally Ann Frobisher.
From Micah Daniels to Juliet, the 15th of May, 1946. Dear Miss Ashton, Isola gave me your address because she is sure you would like to see my list for your book. If you was to take me to Paris today and set me down in a fine French restaurant, the kind of place what has white lace tablecloths, candles on the walls, and silver covers over all the plates, well, I tell you it would be nothing, nothing compared to my Vega box. In case you don't know of it, the Vega was a Red Cross ship that come first to Guernsey on the 27th of December, 1944. They brought food to us then, and five more times, and it kept us alive until the end of the war. Yes, I do say it, kept us alive. Food had not been so plentiful for several years by then. Except for the devils in the black market, not a spoonful of sugar was left on the island. All the flour for bread had run out about the 1st of December of 44. Them German soldiers was as hungry as we was, with bloated bellies and no body warmth from food. Well, I was tired to death of boiled potatoes and turnips, and I would have soon turned up my toes and died when the Vega came into our port. Mr. Churchill, he wouldn't let the Red Cross ships bring us any food before then, because he said the Germans would just take it and eat it up themselves. Now, that may sound like smart planning to you, to starve the villains out, but to me, it said he just didn't care if we starved along with them. Well, something shoved his soul up a notch or two, and he decided we could eat. So in December, he says to the Red Cross, "Oh, all right, go ahead and feed them." Miss Ashton, there were two boxes of food for every man, woman and child on Guernsey, all stored up in the Vega's hold. There was other stuff, too. Nails, seed for planting, candles, oil to cook with, matches to light the fire, some clothing and some shoes, even a few layettes for any new babies around. There was flour and tobacco. Moses can talk about manna all he wants, but he never seen anything like this. I am going to tell you everything in my box, because I wrote it all down to paste in my memory book. 6 ounces of chocolate, 4 ounces of tea, 6 ounces of sugar, 2 ounces of tinned milk, 15 ounces of marmalade, 5 ounces of sardines, 6 ounces of prunes, 1 ounce of salt, 20 ounces of biscuits, 20 ounces of butter, 13 ounces of spam, 8 ounces of raisins, 10 ounces of salmon, 4 ounces of cheese, 1 ounce of pepper, a tablet of soap. I gave my prunes away, but wasn't that something? When I die, I am going to leave all my money to the Red Cross. I have written to tell them so. There is something else I should say to you. It may be about those Germans, but honor due is honor due. They unloaded all those boxes of food for us from the Vega, and they didn't take none, not one box of it, for themselves. Of course, their commandant had told them, that food is for the islanders. It is not yours. Steal one bit and I'll have you shot. Then he gave each man unloading the ship a teaspoon, so as he could scrape up any flour or grain that spilled on the roadway. They could eat that. In fact, they were a pitiful sight, those soldiers, stealing from gardens, knocking on doors asking for scraps. One day I saw a soldier catch up a cat and slam its head against a wall. Then he cut it off and hid the cat in his jacket. I followed him till he come to a field. That German skinned that cat and boiled him up in his billy can and ate it right there. That was truly, truly a sorrowful sight to see. It made me sick. But underneath my sick, I thought, there goes Hitler's Third Reich, dining out. And then I started laughing, fit to die. I am ashamed of that now. But that is what I did. That is all I have to say. I wish you well with your book writing. Yours truly, Micah Daniels.
From John Booker to Juliet. 16th of May, 1946. Dear Miss Ashton, Amelia told us you are coming to Guernsey to gather stories for your book. I will welcome you with all my heart, but I won't be able to tell you about what happened to me because I get the shakes when I talk about it. Maybe if I write it down, you won't need me to say it out loud. It isn't about Guernsey anyway. I wasn't here. I was in Neuen Gamma concentration camp in Germany. You know how I pretended I was Lord Tobias for 3 years? Peter Jenkins's daughter, Lisa, was dating German soldiers. Any German soldier, so long as he would give her stockings or lipsticks. This was so until she took up with Sergeant Willie Gertz. He was a mean little runt. The two of them together be nasty as the mind. It was Lisa who betrayed me to the German commandant. In March of 1944, Lisa was having her hair done in an upsweep at the beauty parlor, where she found an old pre-war copy of Tatler magazine. There, on page 124, was a colored picture of Lord and Lady Tobias Penn Piers. They were at a wedding in Sussex, drinking champagne and eating oysters. The words under the picture told all about her gown, her diamonds, her shoes, her face, and his money. The magazine mentioned that they were owners of an estate called La Forte on the island of Guernsey. Well, it was pretty plain, even to Lisa, who's thick as a post, that Lord Tobias Penn Piers was not me. She did not wait for her hair to be combed out, but left at once to show the picture to Willie Gertz, who took it straight to the commandant. It made the Germans feel like fools, bowing and scraping all that time to a servant, so they were extra spiteful and sent me to the camp at Neuen Gamma. I did not think I would live out the first week. With other prisoners, I was sent out to clear unexploded bombs during air raids. What a choice! To run into the square with the bombs raining down, or to be killed by the guards for refusing. I ran and scuttled like a rat, and tried to cover myself when I heard bombs whistle past my head, and somehow I was alive at the end of it. That's what I told myself. Well, you're still alive. I think all of us said the same each morning when we woke up. Well, I'm still alive. But the truth is, we weren't. What we were, it wasn't dead, but it wasn't alive either. I was a living soul only a few minutes a day when I was in my bunk. Those times, I tried to think of something happy, something I'd liked, but not something I loved, for that made it worse. Just a small thing, like a school picnic, or bicycling downhill. That's all I could stand. It felt like 30 years, but it was only one. In April of 45, the commandant at Neuengamme picked out those of us who were still fit enough to work and sent us to Belsen. We rode for several days in a big open truck. No food, no blankets, no water. But we were glad we weren't walking. The mud puddles in the road were red. I imagine you already know of Belsen and what happened there. When we got off the truck, we were handed shovels. We were to dig great pits to bury the dead. They led us through the camp to the spot, and I feared I'd lost my mind because everyone I saw was dead. Even the living looked like corpses, and the corpses were lying where they'd dropped. I didn't know why they were bothering to bury them. The fact was, the Russians were coming from the east, and the Allies were coming from the west, and those Germans were terrified of what they'd see when they got there. The crematorium could not burn the bodies fast enough. So after we dug long trenches, we pulled and dragged the bodies to the edges and threw them in. You'll not believe it, but the SS forced the prisoners' band to play music as we lugged the corpses, and for that, I hope they burn in hell with polkas blaring. When the trenches were full, the SS poured petrol over the bodies and set fire to them. Afterwards, we were supposed to cover them with dirt, as if you could hide such a thing. The British got there the next day, and dear God, but we were glad to see them. I was strong enough to walk down the road, so I saw the tanks crash down the gates, and I saw the British flag painted on their sides. I turned to a man sitting against a fence nearby and called out, "We're saved, it's the British!" Then I saw he was dead. He had only missed it by minutes. I sat down in the mud and sobbed as though he'd been my best friend. When the Tommies came down out of the tanks, they were weeping too, even the officers. Those good men fed us, gave us blankets, saw us to hospitals, and bless them, they burned Belsen to the ground a month later. I read in the newspaper that they've put up a war refugee camp in its place now. It gives me the shivers to think of new barracks being built there, even for a good purpose. To my mind, that land should be a blank forever. I'll write no more of this, and I hope you'll understand if I do not care to speak of it. As Seneca says, light griefs are loquacious, but the great are dumb. I do recall something you might like to know for your book. It happened in Guernsey, when I was still pretending to be Lord Tobias. Sometimes of an evening, Elizabeth and I would walk up to the headlands to watch the bombers flying over, hundreds of them, on their way to bomb London. It was terrible to watch and know where they were headed and what they meant to do. The German radio had told us London was levelled, flattened, with nothing left but rubble and ashes. We didn't quite believe them, German propaganda being what it was, but still. We were walking through St. Peter Port on one such night when we passed the McLaren House. That was a fine old house taken over by German officers. A window was open, and the wireless was playing a beautiful piece of music. We stopped to listen, thinking it must be a program from Berlin. But when the music ended, we heard Big Ben strike, and a British voice said, "This is the BBC, London." You can never mistake Big Ben's sound. London was still there. Still there. Elizabeth and I hugged, and we started waltzing up the road. That was one of the times I could not think about while I was in Neuengamme. Yours sincerely, John Booker.
From Darcy to Juliet, the 16th of May, 1946. Dear Juliet, there's nothing left to do for your arrival except wait. Isola has washed, starched and ironed Elizabeth's curtains, looked up the chimney for bats, cleaned the windows, made up the beds, and aired all the rooms. Eli has carved a present for you. Eben has filled your woodshed, and Clovis has scythed your meadow, leaving, he says, the clumps of wildflowers for you to enjoy. Amelia is planning a supper party for you on your first evening. My only job is to keep Isola alive until you get here. Heights make her giddy, but nevertheless she climbed to the roof of Elizabeth's cottage to stomp for loose tiles. Fortunately, Kit saw her before she reached the eaves and ran for me to come talk her down. I wish I could do more for your welcome. I hope it may be soon. I am happy you are coming. Yours, Darcy.
Juliet to Darcy, 19th of May, 1946. Dear Darcy, I'll be there the day after tomorrow. I am far too cowardly to fly, even with the inducement of gin, so I shall come by the evening mailboat. Would you give Isola a message for me? Please tell her that I don't own a hat with a veil, and I can't carry lilies. They make me sneeze. But I do have a red wool cape, and I'll wear that on the boat. Darcy, there isn't one thing you could do to make me feel more welcome in Guernsey than you already have. I'm having trouble believing that I'm going to meet you all at last. Yours ever, Juliet.
From Mark to Juliet, May 20th, 1946. Dear Juliet, you asked me to give you time, and I have. You asked me not to mention marriage, and I haven't. But now you tell me that you're off to bloody Guernsey for, what, a week? A month? Forever? Do you think I'm going to sit back and let you go? You're being ridiculous, Juliet. Any half-wit can see that you're trying to run away. But what nobody can understand is why. We're right together. You make me happy. You never bore me. You're interested in the things I'm interested in. And I hope I'm not deluded when I say I think the same is true for you. We belong together. I know you loathe it when I tell you I know what's best for you, but in this case, I do. For God's sake, forget about that miserable island and marry me. I'll take you there on our honeymoon, if I must. Love, Mark.
From Juliet to Mark, 20th of May, 1946. Dear Mark, you're probably right, but even so, I'm going to Guernsey tomorrow, and you can't stop me. I'm sorry I can't give you the answer you want. I would like to be able to. Love, Juliet. P.S. Thank you for the roses.
From Mark to Juliet. Oh, for God's sake. Do you want me to drive you down to Weymouth? Mark.
From Juliet to Mark. Will you promise not to lecture me, Juliet?
From Mark to Juliet. No lectures. However, all other forms of persuasion will be employed. Mark.
From Juliet to Mark. Can't scare me. What can you possibly do while driving, Juliet?
From Mark to Juliet. You'd be surprised. See you tomorrow. M.
Part 2. From Juliet to Sydney, 22nd of May, 1946. Dear Sydney, there's so much to tell you. I've been in Guernsey only 20 hours, but each one has been so full of new faces and ideas that I've reams to write. You see how conducive to working island life is. Look at Victor Hugo. I may grow prolific if I stay here for any length of time. The voyage from Weymouth was ghastly, with the mailboat groaning and creaking and threatening to break to pieces in the waves. I almost wished it would, to put me out of my misery. Except I wanted to see Guernsey before I died. And as soon as we came in sight of the island, I gave up the notion altogether, because the sun broke beneath the clouds and set the cliffs shimmering into silver. As the mailboat lurched into the harbour, I saw St. Peter Port rising up from the sea on terraces, with a church on the top like a cake decoration, and I realized that my heart was galloping. As much as I tried to persuade myself it was the thrill of the scenery, I knew better. All those people I've come to know, and even love a little, waiting to see me. And I, without any paper to hide behind. Sydney, in these past 2 or 3 years, I have become better at writing than living, and think what you do to my writing. On the page, I'm perfectly charming, but that's just a trick I learned. It has nothing to do with me. At least, that's what I was thinking as the mailboat came toward the pier. I had a cowardly impulse to throw my red cape overboard and pretend I was someone else. When we drew right alongside the pier, I could see the faces of the people waiting, and then there was no going back. I knew them by their letters. There was Isola, in a mad hat and a purple shawl pinned with a glittering brooch. She was smiling fixedly in the wrong direction, and I loved her instantly. Next to her stood a man with a lined face, and at his side a boy, all height and angles. Eben and his grandson Eli. I waved to Eli, and he smiled like a beam of light and nudged his grandfather. And then I got shy and lost myself in the crowd that was pushing down the gangplank. Isola reached me first by leaping over a crate of lobsters and grabbed me up in a fierce hug that swung me off my feet. "Ah, lovey," she cried, while I dangled. Wasn't that dear? All my nervousness was squeezed right out of me, along with my breath. The others came toward me more quietly, but with no less warmth. Eben shook my hand and smiled. You can tell he was broad and hardy once, but he is too thin now. He somehow looks both grave and friendly at the same time. How does he manage to do that? I found myself wanting to impress him. Eli swung Kit up on his shoulders, and they came forward together. Kit has chubby little legs and a stern face. Dark curls, big grey eyes. And she did not take to me one bit. Eli's jersey was speckled in wood shavings, and he had a present for me in his pocket. An adorable little mouse with crooked whiskers, carved from walnut. I gave him a kiss on the cheek, and survived Kit's malevolent glare. She has a very forbidding way about her for a 4-year-old. Then Dawsey held out his hands. I had been expecting him to look like Charles Lamb. And he does, a little. He has the same even gaze. He presented me with a bouquet of carnations from Booker, who couldn't be present. He had concussed himself during a rehearsal and was in hospital overnight for observation. Dawsey is dark and wiry, and his face has a quiet, watchful look about it, until he smiles. Saving a certain sister of yours, he has the sweetest smile I've ever seen, and I remembered Amelia writing that he has a rare gift for persuasion. I can believe it. Like Eben, like everyone here, he is too thin, though you can tell he was more substantial once. His hair is going grey, and he has deep-set brown eyes, so dark they look black. The lines around his eyes make him seem to be starting a smile, even when he's not. But I don't think he's over 40. He is only a little taller than I am, and limps slightly. But he's strong. He hefted all my luggage, me, Amelia, and Kit, into his wagon, with no trouble. I shook hands with him. I can't remember if he said anything, and then he stepped aside for Amelia. She's one of those ladies who is more beautiful at 60 than she could possibly have been at 20. Oh, How I hope someone says that about me someday. Small, thin-faced, lovely smile, with grey hair in coronet braids, she gripped my hand tightly and said, "Juliet, I am glad you are here at last. Let's get your things and go home." It sounded wonderful, as though it really were my home. As we stood there on the pier, some glint of light kept flashing in my eyes, and then around the dock. Isola snorted and said it was Adelaide Addison, at her window with opera glasses, tracking every move we made. Isola waved vigorously at the gleam, and it stopped. While we were laughing about that, Dorsey was seeing to my bags and making sure that Kit didn't fall off the pier and generally making himself useful. I began to see that this is what he does, and that everyone depends upon him to do it. The four of us, Amelia, Kit, Dorsey and I, rode to Amelia's farm in Dorsey's cart, while everyone else walked. It wasn't far except in terms of landscape, for we moved from St. Peter Port out into the countryside. There are rolling pasture lands, but they end suddenly at cliffs, and all around is the moist, salt smell of the sea. As we drove, the sun set and the mist rose. You know how sounds become magnified in the fog? Well, it was like that. Every bird's chirp was weighty and symbolic. Clouds boiled up over the cliff sides, and the fields were swathed in grey by the time we reached the manor house. But I saw ghostly shapes that I think were the cement bunkers built by the tote workers. Kit sat beside me in the wagon and sent me many sideways glances. I was not so foolish as to try to talk to her, but I played my severed thumb trick. You know, the one that makes your thumb look like it has been sliced apart. I did it over and over, casually, not looking at her, while she watched me like a baby hawk. She was intent and fascinated, but not gullible enough to break into giggles. She just said at last, "Show me how you do that." She sat across from me at supper and turned down her spinach with a thrust-out arm, hand straight up like a policeman. "Not for me," she said, and I, for one, would not care to disobey her. She pulled her chair close to Dorsey's and ate with one elbow planted firmly on his arm, pinning him in his place. He didn't appear to mind, even if it did make cutting his chicken difficult. And when supper was over, she immediately climbed into his lap. It is obviously her rightful throne, and though Dorsey seemed to be attending to the conversation, I spied him poking out a napkin rabbit while we talked of food shortages during the occupation. Did you know that the islanders ground birdseed for flour until they ran out of it? I must have passed some test I didn't know I was being given, because Kit asked me to tuck her into bed. She wanted to hear a story about a ferret. She liked vermin. Did I? Would I kiss a rat on the lips? I said, never. And that apparently won her favour. I was plainly a coward, but not a hypocrite. I told her a story, and she presented her cheek, an infinitesimal quarter of an inch to be kissed. What a long letter, and it only contains the first 4 hours of the 20. You'll have to wait for the other 16. Love, Juliet. From Juliet to Sophie, 24th of May, 1946. Dearest Sophie, yes, I'm here. Mark did his best to stop me, but I resisted him mulishly, right to the bitter end. I've always considered doggedness one of my least appealing characteristics, but it was valuable last week. It was only as the boat pulled away, and I saw him standing on the pier, tall and scowling, and somehow wanting to marry me, that I began to think maybe he was right. Maybe I am a complete idiot. I know 3 women who are mad for him. He'll be snapped up in a trice, and I'll be spending my declining years in a grimy bedsit, with my teeth falling out one by one. Oh, I can see it all now. No one will buy my books, and I'll ply Sydney with tattered, illegible manuscripts which he'll pretend to publish out of pity. doddering and muttering, I'll wander the streets carrying my pathetic turnips in a string bag, with newspaper tucked into my shoes. You'll send me affectionate cards at Christmas, won't you? And I'll brag to strangers that I was once nearly engaged to Markham Reynolds, the publishing tycoon. They'll shake their heads. The poor old thing's crazy as a bedbug, of course, but harmless. Oh, God, this way lies insanity. Guernsey is beautiful, and my new friends have welcomed me so generously, so warmly, that I haven't doubted I've done right to come here, until just a moment ago, when I started thinking about my teeth. I'm going to stop thinking about them. I'm going to step into the meadow of wild flowers right outside my door and run to the cliff as fast as I can. Then I'm going to fall down and look at the sky, which is shimmering like a pearl this afternoon, and breathe in the warm scent of grass and pretend that Markham V. Reynolds doesn't exist. I've just come back indoors. It's hours later. The setting sun has rimmed the clouds in blazing gold, and the sea is moaning at the bottom of the cliffs. Mark Reynolds? Who's he? Love always, Juliet. From Juliet to Sydney, 27th of May, 1946. Dear Sydney, Elizabeth's cottage was plainly built for an exalted guest to stay in, because it's quite spacious. There is a big sitting room, a bathroom, a larder, and a huge kitchen downstairs. There are three bedrooms and a bath upstairs. And best of all, there are windows everywhere, so the sea air can sweep into every room. I've shoved a writing table by the biggest window in my sitting room. The only flaw in this arrangement is the constant temptation to go outside and walk over to the cliff's edge. The sea and the clouds don't stay the same for 5 minutes running, and I'm scared I'll miss something if I stay inside. When I got up this morning, the sea was full of sun pennies, and now it all seems to be covered in lemon scrim. Writers ought to live far inland, or next to the city dump, if they are ever to get any work done. Or perhaps they need to be stronger-minded than I am. If I needed any encouragement to be fascinated by Elizabeth, which I don't, her possessions would do it for me. The Germans arrived to take over Sir Ambrose's house and gave her only 6 hours to remove her belongings to the cottage. Isola said Elizabeth brought only a few pots and pans, some cutlery and kitchen china. The Germans kept the good silver, crystal, china and wine for themselves. Her art supplies, an old wind-up phonograph, some records, and the rest were armloads of books. So many books, Sydney, that I haven't had time to really look at them. They fill the living room shelves and overflow into the kitchen hutch. She even set a stack at the end of the sofa to use for a table. Wasn't that brilliant? In every nook, I find little things that tell me about her. She was a noticer, Sydney, like me, for all the shelves are lined with shells, bird feathers, dried seagrasses, pebbles, eggshells, and the skeleton of something that might be a bat. They're just bits that were lying on the ground that anyone else would step over or on. But she saw they were beautiful and brought them home. I wonder if she used them for still lifes. I wonder if her sketchbooks are here somewhere. There's prowling to be done. Work first, but the anticipation is like Christmas Eve 7 days a week. Elizabeth also carried down one of Sir Ambrose's paintings. It is a portrait of her, painted, I imagine, when she was about 8 years old. She is sitting on a swing, all ready to pump up and away, but having to sit still for Sir Ambrose to paint. You can tell by her eyebrows that she doesn't like it. Glares must be inheritable, because she and Kit have identical ones. My cottage is right inside the gates, honest, three-barred farm gates. The meadow surrounding the cottage is full of scattered wildflowers until you get to the cliff's edge, where rough grass and gorse take over. The big house, for want of a better name, is the one that Elizabeth came to close up for Ambrose. It is just up the drive from the cottage and is a wonderful house. Two-storied, L-shaped, and made of beautiful blue-grey stone. It's slate-roofed, with dormer windows and a terrace stretching from the crook of the L down its length. The top of the crooked end has a windowed turret and faces the sea. Most of the huge old trees had to be cut down for firewood, but Mr. Dilwyn has asked Eben and Eli to plant new trees, chestnuts and oaks. He is also going to have peach trees espaliered next to the brick garden walls as soon as they are rebuilt too. The house is beautifully proportioned, with wide, tall windows that open straight out onto the stone terrace. The lawn is growing green and lush again, covering up the wheel ruts of German cars and trucks. Escorted at different times by Eben, Eli, Dorsey or Isola, I have quartered the island's 10 parishes in the past 5 days. Guernsey is very beautiful in all its variety. Fields, woods, hedgerows, dells, manors, dolmens, wild cliffs, witches' corners, Tudor barns, and Norman cottages of stone. I have been told stories of her history, very lawless, with almost every new site and building. Guernsey pirates had superior taste. They built beautiful homes and impressive public buildings. These are sadly dilapidated and in need of repair, but their architectural beauty shows through anyway. Dorsey took me to a tiny church, every inch of which is a mosaic of broken china and smashed pottery. One priest did this all by himself. He must have made pastoral calls with a sledgehammer. My guides are as various as the sights. Isola tells me about cursed pirate chests bound with bleached bones washing up on the beaches, and what Mr. Hallett is hiding inside his barn. He says it's a calf, but we know better. Eben describes how things used to look before the war, and Eli disappears suddenly and then returns with peach juice and an angelic smile on his face. Dorsey says the least, but he takes me to see wonders, like the tiny church. Then he stands back and lets me enjoy them as long as I want. He's the most unhurrying person I've ever met. As we were walking along the road yesterday, I noticed that it cut very close to the cliffs, and there was a trail leading down to the beach below. "Is this where you met Christian Hellman?" I asked. Dorsey looked startled and said, "Yes, this was the spot." "What did he look like?" I asked, for I wanted to picture the scene. I expected it was a futile request, given that men cannot describe each other. But Dorsey knew how. He looked like the German you imagine. Tall, blonde hair, blue eyes. Except he could feel pain. With Amelia and Kit, I have walked to town several times for tea. Cece was right in his raptures over sailing into St. Peter Port. The harbour, with the town traipsing straight up and steeply to the sky, must be one of the most beautiful in the world. Shop windows on High Street and the Pollet are sparkling clean and are beginning to fill up with new goods. St. Peter Port may be essentially drab right now, so many buildings need refurbishing, but it does not give off the dead, tired air poor London does. It must be because of the bright light that flows down on everything and the clean, clear air and flowers growing everywhere, in fields, on verges and crannies, between paving stones. You really have to be Kit's height to see this world properly. She's grand at pointing out certain things I would otherwise miss. Butterflies, spiders, flowers growing tiny and low to the ground. They're hard to see when you are faced with a blazing wall of fuchsias and bougainvillea. Yesterday, I came upon Kit and Dorsey crouched in the brush beside the gate, quiet as thieves. They weren't stealing, though. They were watching a blackbird tug a worm out of the ground. The worm put up a good fight, and the three of us sat there in silence until the blackbird finally got it down his gullet. I'd never really seen the entire process before. It's revolting. Kit carries a little box with her sometimes when we go to town, a cardboard box, tied up tight with cord and a red yarn handle. Even when we have tea, She holds it on her lap and is very protective of it. There are no air holes in the box, so it can't be a ferret. Or, oh Lord, maybe it's a dead ferret. I'd love to know what's in it, but of course I can't ask. I do like it here, and I'm settled in well enough to start work now. I will, as soon as I come back from fishing with Eben and Eli this afternoon. Love to you and Piers, Juliet. From Juliet to Sydney, 30th of May, 1946. Dear Sydney, do you remember when you sat me down for 15 sessions of the Sydney Stark School of Perfect Mnemonics? You said writers who sat scribbling notes during an interview were rude, lazy, and incompetent, and you were going to make sure I never disgraced you. You were unbearably arrogant, and I loathed you. But I learned your lessons well, and now you can see the fruits of your hard work. I went to my first meeting of the Guernsey Literary and Potato Peel Pie Society last night. It was held in Clovis and Nancy Fossey's living room, with spillover into the kitchen. The speaker of the evening was a new member, Jonas Skeeter, who was to talk about the Meditations of Marcus Aurelius. Mr. Skeeter strode to the front of the room, glared at us all, and announced he didn't want to be there and had only read Marcus Aurelius's silly book because his oldest, his dearest, and his former friend, Woodrow Cutter, had shamed him into it. Everyone turned to look at Woodrow, and Woodrow sat there, obviously shocked and his mouth agape. Woodrow, Jonas Skeeter went on, came across my field where I was busy, building up my compost. He was holding this little book in his hands, and he said he'd just finished reading it. He'd like me to read it too, he said. It was very profound. Woodrow, I've got no time to be profound, I said. He said, you should make time, Jonas. If you'd read it, we'd have better things to talk about at Crazy Ida's. We'd have more fun over a pint. Now, that hurt my feelings. No good saying it didn't. My childhood friend had been holding himself above me for some time, all because he read books for you people and I didn't. I'd let it pass before, to each his own, as my mum always said. But now he had gone too far. He had insulted me. He put himself above me in conversation. Jonas, he said, Marcus was a Roman emperor and a mighty warrior. This book is what he thought about, down there among the Quadi. They were barbarians who was waiting in the woods to kill all the Romans, and Marcus, hard-pressed as he was by those Quades, he took the time to write up this little book of his thoughts. He had long, long thoughts, and we could use some of those, Jonas. So I pushed down my hurt and took the damned book. But I came here tonight to say before all, shame, Woodrow. Shame on you to put a book above your boyhood friend. But I did read it, and here is what I think. Marcus Aurelius was an old woman, forever taking his mind's temperature, forever wondering about what he had done or what he had not done. Was he right or was he wrong? Was the rest of the world in error? Could it be him instead? No, it was everybody else who was wrong, and he set matters straight for them. Broody hen that he was, he never had a tiny thought that he couldn't turn into a sermon. Why, I bet the man couldn't even take a piss. Someone gasped. Piss! He said piss in front of ladies. Make him apologize, cried another. He doesn't have to apologize. He's supposed to say what he thinks, and that's what he thinks, like it or not. Woodrow, how could you so hurt your friend? For shame, Woodrow. The room fell quiet when Woodrow stood up. The two men met in the middle of the floor. Jonas held out his hand to Woodrow, and Woodrow clapped Jonas on the back, and the two of them left, arm in arm, for Crazy Ida's. I hope that's a pub and not a woman. Love, Juliet. P.S. Dawsey was the only society member who seemed to find last night's meeting at all funny. He's too polite to laugh out loud, but I saw his shoulders shaking. I gathered from the others that it had been a satisfying but by no means extraordinary evening. Love again, Juliet. From Juliet to Sydney, 31st of May, 1946. Dear Sydney, please read the enclosed letter. I found it slipped under my door this morning.
Dear Miss Ashton, Miss Pribby told me you wanted to know about our recent occupation by the German army. So here is my letter. I am a small man, and though Mother says I never had a prime, I did. I just didn't tell her about it. I am a champion whistler. I have won contests and prizes for my whistling. During the occupation, I used this talent to unman the enemy. After Mother was asleep, I would creep out of the house. I'd make my silent way down to the German's brothel, if you'll pardon the term, on Saumarez Street. I'd hide in the shadows until a soldier emerged from his tryst. I do not know if ladies are aware of this, but men are not at their peak of fitness after such an occasion. The soldier would start walking back to his quarters, often whistling. I'd start slowly walking, whistling the same tune, but much better. He'd stop whistling, but I would not stop whistling. He'd pause a second, thinking that what he had taken for an echo was actually another person in the dark, following him. But who? He would look back. I'd have slipped into a doorway. He'd see no one. He'd start on his way again, but not whistling. I'd stop to walk again and to whistle again. He'd stop. I'd stop. He'd hurry on, but I'd still whistle, following him with hard footsteps. The soldier would rush toward his quarters, and I'd return to the brothel to wait for another German to stalk. I do believe I made many a soldier unfit to perform his duties well the next day. Do you see? Now, if you'll pardon me, I will speak more about brothels. I do not believe those young ladies were there because they wanted to be. They were sent from the occupied territories of Europe, same as the tote slave workers. It could not have been nice work. To the soldiers' credit, they demanded the German authorities give the women an extra food allowance, same as given to the island's heavy workers. Furthermore, I saw some of these same ladies share their food with the tote workers, who were sometimes let out of their camps at night to hunt for food. My mother's sister lives on Jersey. Now that the war is over, she can come visit us, more's the pity. Being the sort of woman she is, she told a nasty story. After D-Day, the Germans decided to send their brothel ladies back to France, so they put them all on a boat to Saint-Malo. Now, those waters are very wayward, broiled up, and ugly. Their boat was swept onto the rocks, and all aboard were drowned. You could see those poor drowned women, their yellow hair, bleached hussies, my aunt called them, spread out in the water, washing against the rocks. "Serve them right, the whores," my aunt said. She and my mother laughed. It was not to be borne. I jumped up from my chair and knocked the tea table over on them deliberately. I called them dirty old bats. My aunt says she will never set foot in our house again, and Mother hasn't spoken to me since that day. I found it all very peaceful. Yours truly, Henry A. Toussaint.
From Juliet to Sydney, 6th of June, 1946. Mr. Sydney Stark, Stevens and Stark Limited, 21 St. James's Place, London, SW1. Dear Sydney, I could hardly believe it was you telephoning from London last night. How wise of you not to tell me you were flying home. You know how planes terrify me, even when they aren't dropping bombs. Wonderful to know you are no longer five oceans away, but only across the channel. Will you come to see us as soon as you can? Isola is better than a stalking horse. She has brought seven people over to tell me their occupation stories, and I have a growing packet of interview notes. But for now, notes are all they are. I don't know yet if a book is possible, or, if possible, what form it should take. Kit has taken to spending some of her mornings here. She brings rocks or shells and sits quietly. Well, moderately.